Welcome to Engaging Culture. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And on this episode, we bring in resident friendship guru, Pastor Heather Johnson, to talk to us about how we can make friends in different seasons of life. We talk about why Starbucks is in trouble and what that trouble might be pointing to. Then we bring in Ashley Sarin, principal of Roseville High School, to talk about how parents can best support their teenage students as they are adjusting to the new school year. We'll have a little fun along the way. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hello, everyone. Hello, Pastor Judah.
Good morning.
How we doing?
Doing all right. In the land of the living.
In the land.
Always a good place to be.
That, you know, it is a good place to be. Let's get right into it. Best thing you saw this week.
Yeah, so the best thing I saw this week, I had the opportunity to officiate a wedding of one of my students.
Oh,
and
nice.
It was a wedding of mixed culture. And so one party in the wedding is Russian and the other is white American. And what was really sweet was they decided at their reception to have these games that their guests could play while they were taking pictures and doing things. Mm-hmm. And one of the games was Human Bingo, which is where you have a bingo sheet with a bunch of different attributes of a person. Maybe they own a cat or they own a dog or they have been out of the country. And you try to find people at the event who can check those boxes. And the goal is to get all the boxes checked and you win. So they're playing this game, and the bride, who is not Russian, she just so sweetly decides that she's going to make a version of the human bingo sheet in Russian for her Russian in-laws, her older Russian in-laws.
Oh, boy.
The challenge is she used Google Translator.
Oh, goodness.
And so the bingo boxes, instead of saying things like has a cat or has a dog, said things like eats a cat, eats a dog, and a bunch of other, like, just tiny little grammatical errors, as Google Translate doesn't always do a great job of translating in a way that makes sense for the rules of that particular language. And so it was very funny, and it blessed me greatly to see the grandparents, the Russian grandparents, looking at the bingo sheet, just being highly confused about why they were supposed to look for somebody who eats cats.
Frankly, I'm just glad they were confused, and they're not like, oh, yeah,
my
auntie,
cousin.
She does that, right?
So. It was, you know, it was super sweet because it was effort, and it was heart, and I don't know. It just blessed me, and I think that's at least among the best things I saw this week. What about you?
Fantastic. Well, yesterday, we're recording here on a Monday, was my wife and I's 17th wedding anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
So that was pretty cool. We went away on Friday night just up to Placerville and had a nice time just kind of being together, went out to dinner, did all that, and just, you know, reflecting on life and marriage and kids and everything else. And we have this silly tradition. It started our first anniversary where we scribble the number, usually on a napkin or on something, and then take a picture. So we scribbled a number 17 at the restaurant, took the picture, and it's just, I don't know, it's so funny. I still think of myself as a parent of young children, even though they're both in middle school, and I still think of myself as relatively newly married. But then you go, man, 17 years, that's a long time.
What's the biggest lesson you feel like you've learned about marriage from these 17 years? Like, what did you not know at the beginning that you're like, everybody who gets married should be told this?
The extent to which, you just have to deal with your own stuff. Like, you live up close with a human, you are intimately aware of all of their flaws. And even when they're your spouse, even when they're someone you love very much, there are inevitably going to be things about them that irritate you and frustrate you. And not to say that, you know, you don't need to do the work and you don't need to kind of both work on yourselves. And like, we've been to counseling and we've done all that. But at the end of the day, if I want to improve my marriage, the best way for me to do that is work on my own stuff.
That's good.
And I've seen that play out in a bunch of different ways. And I think that's a big reason why we're healthier now than we were even 3, 4, 5 years ago. So we'll be right back. For our next segment today, there was a syndicated column that came out over the weekend, and it was all over the place, but I saw it in the Sacramento Bee. And the headline, Pastor Judah, was this. Starbucks is in trouble. Let's blame those picky customers who hold up the line. And I was a journalist in my earlier life, not professionally, but in college, seminary, all of that. And I can appreciate a well-written paragraph. And I just want to read the first two paragraphs of the article.
Yes, please.
Five or six words. That's all it should take to order one cup of coffee. If you want to exchange pleasantries with the person taking the order, fine. But the order itself should be concise. We're not buying a new car or adopting a pet or signing up for flying lessons. We're requesting a coffee or maybe an iced tea, and that does not need to be complicated. Unfortunately, some Starbucks customers never got that message, which explains why you might get stuck behind someone who orders something like this. Venti, half whole milk, 1/4 1%, 1/4 non-fat, extra hot, no foam latte with whip, 2 packets of sugar, 1.5 pumps of vanilla syrup, and 3.5 sprinkles of cinnamon. Full disclosure,
and we'd like it in a train to cup.
That's right. I have not. This individual, I believe it's a woman, says, I have not heard someone order anything like that, but I've read about it. Starbucks orders are getting too complicated. Pastor Jude, and Starbucks is suffering as a result.
Yeah.
I think this speaks to something deeper societally than just particularity about coffee. And I know that you see that as well. What are some of the problems that you see with this?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, you know, the article talked about how essentially it's like negatively impacting Starbucks's efficiency, right?
Yes.
That their lines are longer. As I was reading it, I was thinking about how there was a season where I would get a cup of coffee every single morning from Starbucks before I went to the gym, mm-hmm. and how like I would always do the drive-thru and always be waiting a minute, right? So there's a real impact. But I think you're right about the deeper meaning. And I think the first thing that is showing us is that I don't always think it's a great idea for us to have unlimited choices.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I think choice and a lot of choice is kind of a centerpiece of American culture,
mm-hmm.
That I'm not sure is so healthy, because what it allows is for us to feel like our desires take priority over everything else, over the experience of other people, over the efficiency of time. And I think that that's something unique to the United States of America, that has a way of causing problems in the larger way that we share space, right? So like you think about Starbucks and you think, it's not that serious. If I got to wait a couple extra minutes, a few extra minutes, the author talks about waiting like 25 minutes to get a drink one time. You think, it's not that serious. But I think about the importance of having a community-centric lens, having a lens that says that the only way that we can do this all together well is if we are all constantly thinking about how my individual rights, desires, behavior, needs impact and intersect with everybody else's.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the issues with like the unlimited choices at Starbucks in this kind of micro way that speaks to something bigger.
I think you're absolutely right. And certainly the idea of too many choices actually decreases our happiness is well documented. We'll link to the show notes, a brilliant TED talk by a guy named Barry Schwartz about this very topic. Mm-hmm. He calls it the paradox of choice. And it's an old TED talk, 17 years old, has almost 6 million views on YouTube. And it really impacted me, even in the way that I live my life, to go, okay, I can be overwhelmed by so many different choices. And part of the problem is when we have so many choices, we expect that we're going to find perfection.
Yeah, that's right.
Starbucks has over 200,000 combinations of drinks, and I think that's actually very, very low. I heard a number recently. I don't recall what it was. It might have been in the millions of possible kind of different types of drinks you can get.
Yeah, I think it was 170,000.
Well, 170,000 was in the article from 2020, but I think it's much higher than that now. And it can cause us to have sort of absurd expectations for how much we're going to like our coffee. Surely, if there's, let's take that, even that number. If there's 170,000 options, surely I'm going to find one that is perfect. And if I'm expecting something perfect, I'm not going to be able to appreciate pretty good.
That's
so
right.
That is a topic, or I should say a concept that I've applied in my life all over the place, of just going, where do I need to eliminate choice for the purpose of just sort of being happy with what I have? So I think you're right. And I think more broadly to your second point, this idea of kind of hyper-individualism, where on the one hand, we're going to a place, we're paying money, we're placing an order of something that the company offers. So we go, well, like, what's the issue here? Like, I'm just taking advantage of the service they provide.
They said they offer this.
Sure. Mm. I do think there is a part for us to go, okay, how are my actions impacting the people around me, the employees, things like that. And it can be easy to forget about that in kind of our hyper-individualistic world.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that Starbucks is really having to contend with this choice to give us so many options because they're also facing like some major staffing needs. Yeah. Because when people are coming up with the, like an example of the order that you order, and I have heard people order stuff like that.
Excuse me, not the order I order.
The order that you read. That's right.
A very boring
Pastor
coffee
Brian
order.
I would never do that. But the point is that it's also impacting like their bottom line, and their employees. And I think like I was thinking about how this concept, like really, we really saw it during in kind of every area where we have lots of choice, we also tend to see a lot of like tribalism and beefing, right? So what I immediately think of is school. Right. And you can do private school. You can do Christian school. You can do public school. You can do homeschool. You can do unschool. You can do there's lots of options.
Sure.
And then what do we end up doing? We end up saying, well, I'm in this camp. This is my choice. Yep. And my choice is the better one. And yours are terrible. And you shouldn't, you know. And so I think that there is something to be said for when we look at other countries who have higher peace indexes, and you can Google peace indexes, that they actually tend to be places where there's a lot less choice. Right. Where when you go to even I think about countries I've been to where you go into the restaurant and they literally have three things on the menu.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you may look at it and say, I really, you know, had a taste for this or I wanted the chicken cooked this way. But there's actually something peaceful about being able to say, you know what? I got three choices and I got to choose one and make peace with it.
Yeah.
I think about how, you know, I'm not advocating for arranged marriages. But what I will say is that I have even seen in those cultural spaces how because you didn't have a bunch of choice, you just had to make it work with whoever you ended up with, as opposed to a bunch of us that have been through 28 different dating relationships, again, because of this wild choice. So my wild amount of choices. So my question is, in a world and in a culture that does offer us so very much, right? Like, we can't control what Starbucks necessarily puts on their menu.
Yeah.
How should we, and how are you, like, looking at eliminating so many choices when in reality, like, you have a lot of choices?
Yeah. Well, first of all, to your point about relationships, I think that's absolutely true, that we see the paradox of choice in relational satisfaction because, and I've talked about this from the stage a few weeks ago. I alluded to it that, you know, we have access to an unlimited number of individuals. So we expect, surely I'm going to find somebody who is perfect and who doesn't require me to work on myself because they're so, and that's a totally unrealistic expectation. And I think there's a spiritual element to the question you just asked to kind of go, okay, what am I asking my things to do for me? There was a period of time where I like switched with a razor blade I use like three times in the course of like 2 years. And then I finally realized like it's shaving. It's not a party. It's not a massage.
Relax.
Like I think sort of my expectations of this like amazing experience are perhaps a little unrealistic. And to recognize that this longing that exists in my heart is not going to get filled by the perfect cup of coffee, the perfect Impossible Burger in my case, the perfect this or that, but rather like, you know, to paraphrase C.S. Lewis, like we have longings that this world cannot satisfy. We're made for another world. To let even the longing that I feel as the cup of coffee's okay, the jeans are fine, the vacation was good, to go, okay, my ultimate sense of identity and purpose is in Christ. And what that also does is it sort of takes the pressure off some of these other things. Because I actually do think that take coffee as a microcosm of it, that some of this hyper-specificity is this, I want control, I want to be unique,
I want
to feel special and important.
That's right.
And I don't mean to like totally clown that because I think there's something in us that longs to feel this sense of like acceptance of who we are.
Yeah.
And to recognize—
and exceptionalism and all that.
Yeah, but like this idea of acceptance doesn't come from, well, now Starbucks has to make my wild order. Okay, now if I, let's say I buy a new car, like I have it customized so that there's not a single one like it in the world. My sense of just radical acceptance comes from Jesus, not from, okay, I got all of my preferences met.
That's right. So, I also think that it builds the muscle of flexibility and of I wish I had better language for this, but of like being low maintenance, yeah. right? Which is really important because like what we saw during the pandemic was all of a sudden our choices became very, very limited. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us really, really struggled with that for a wide variety of reasons. Sure. But one of those reasons was we were unaccustomed to not having as many options, to not having as much autonomy as we would like, and to having to being in a position where we had to make decisions yeah. for the sake of the whole and not just us. And when we look at other countries who, because of their infrastructure, their economy, whatever, are more accustomed to saying, no, you don't have as many choices. Yeah. They actually were able to walk through the pandemic, I think, a little bit with a little bit more ease than we were. And yeah. we were just kind of like losing our minds and understandably so. But I think that these kind of little ways of saying, hey, I actually don't need to have all of this control. And I actually don't need everything to be perfectly how I like it. And I don't have that expectation for it to be, I think can really serve us in case, you know, something else unexpected and hard hits our lives in a way that, you know, reduces our options.
Yep, that's right. Absolutely agree. We'll be right back.
So we are joined today in the studio by none other than our own Pastor Heather. And Pastor Heather, you and I and Pastor Brian were reading an article that came out of Time Magazine by Angela Haupt. I think that's how you say her name.
Nice.
Where essentially she was saying that it's really difficult actually to make friends as an adult. And that reality is not tied simply to like, oh, you're socially awkward, so it's hard. But it just kind of across the board for adult human beings that it is hard to make friends. And one of the things that you do here, Pastor Heather, at Bridgeway, is you pastor and you shepherd our community groups. And a part of what we hope will kind of come out of those groups is friendship. What are you learning about what makes it difficult to make friends, to sustain friendships for adults? What are some of the barriers that you're seeing?
Yeah, I think the number one barrier is busyness. Mm. I mean, just hands down. Busyness. Yeah. No matter what season of life, even retired, making the space in your life for friendships is really, really hard.
So I hear you saying it sounds like that it's hard to prioritize it.
Yeah.
And usually we prioritize things based on the like return of investment.
Yeah,
right?
Good observation.
And so what would you say to somebody who is not prioritizing their friendships, making friends, sustaining friendships, in order to kind of convince them of the value of it? What, like, why is it important to us?
Yeah, I think that often, I mean, some of the things we talk about in our START program, which is primarily how we launch groups here at Bridgeway and in groups, spiritual friendships is the grounding piece of a group. I mean, yes, spiritual growth, yes, serving together, but all of that is done out of the groundwork of friendship. Mm. And so I think that some of the things we talk about and start on a pretty regular basis is this idea that when things are going well and we're super busy, we don't really we're self-sufficient. Like we don't need friends. We're good. And not to be weird about it, but we're cultivating friends. There is return on investment right away. I mean, just companionship and camaraderie and, you know, yeah, me too. You know, kind of all of those wonderful attributes of friends, fun, laughter. But we are also cultivating friendships for the hard times. Because life is hard and it's going to get hard eventually, even if it's not right now. And that's when you really feel the lack of friendships. And so it's kind of a weird thing because you might not feel the need for it now, but often what we're investing in now will benefit us in the future.
And I think actually, you know, Pastor Judy, you're talking about this idea that we make decisions based on return on investment. I'm not sure that's totally true all the time.
Talk to me.
And I think that's part of the problem, right? Mm. That, like on some level, we do. But how often is it that when life gets busy, often the first things to go are the things that are ultimately the building block to a satisfying and joyful life. Oh, I'm too busy to have daily time with the Lord. Oh, I'm too busy to connect with that friend because I've got to get to the practice or go to the thing or attend the meeting or work's crazy and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But it is very rare that we go, oh my gosh, my life is so busy. I really need to dial back on work. Like most of us will go, okay, well, I can't meet with my community group. I can't have friends. I can't do this stuff. And I think that there is this sense of urgency that we live with that causes us to kind of lose sight of what is most important. And if you'll forgive the cliche, like that is, I feel like, my life half the time. Yeah. So that is unfortunately how I know of what I speak. And I think it's a real challenge to go, okay, how do I really make sure I'm prioritizing those life-giving things?
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that was really interesting about the article was that it talked about how there are different barriers to different life stages, right? That in your kind of early adulthood, you have a different kind of set of circumstances that, you know, make not only it difficult to find friends in a unique way to somebody who is entering into parenthood for the first time or in the middle kind of stages of their lives, but also it talked about some different ways to approach making friends for those different, you know, life stages. And so one of the things that it said for specifically, you know, I have a heart for folks who are older and kind of in that that midlife space, because I think that when you're younger, there are some built-in, whether it's college or trade school or, you know, we're working at the McDonald's and everybody else who's working here is probably 23 too. And so one of the things that it said for people in their mid-30s to their 40s is that they should reframe how they think about friendship in terms of when you're very young, high school and then young adult, you're looking for your best friend, the person who scratches all your itches and meets all your needs in all the perfect ways, who you're just like so perfectly compatible with and aligned with. And what the article said was that as you get older, those days are gone, right? And that we should be open to being a part of different friend groups that fulfill different pieces of who we are as an adult. And as folks who are kind of entering into that 30s and 40s, that space, how are you two, Pastor Heather and Pastor Brian, making friends and maintaining your friendships in that particular season?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I actually intentionally practice a lot is good question asking. Because I feel like, well, there's a quote in David Brooks' book on, and it's, you know, it says a good conversation is a two-way exchange. And then there's the psychologist in that same paragraph that says, what the eye sees more deeply, the hearts tend to love more tenderly. It's a beautiful quote because I think we underestimate the value of conversation and the value of a good question. And I can transform, but our conversation can transform into a meaningful conversation in 15 minutes with a good exchange back and forth and a good question. And it can, it's just a little bit of intentionality on our part about why we're getting together. You know, we can talk about all the fun things that we need to talk about. You know, how are the kids? How are the folks? How are the sports? You know, how's the lawn? I don't know. You know, all the things that we spend a lot of time talking about. But if our conversations don't get to that more intimate space, the more intentional space, we'll still walk away feeling unknown. And so some of it is taking the relationships we already have in all the different spaces. It could be on the, you know, it could be on the playground. It could be at coffee. It could even be in the lobby at church. But trying with the, you know, the help of the Holy Spirit to take those conversations to a little more meaningful place and look for that back and forth exchange. Like that's really important when we're cultivating friendships. We want to be friendly to everybody, but when we're really looking for friends to take that beyond acquaintances, then we're looking for, you know, some level of equality in back and forth exchange.
And I think that's something like you've modeled for me extremely well, Heather, and that I've tried to emulate is just that sense of, yeah, being a good question asker, being curious. And I think about different places in my life where I'll set different reminders for like, okay, ask that person about that thing.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, because I don't know, I'm scatterbrained or whatever. Or even, you know, little things like, okay, last baseball practice was talking to that mom mm-hmm. about her shoulder surgery. She's wearing a sling. Okay, at the game the other day, she wasn't wearing the sling. Hey, how's the shoulder?
Yeah.
How are things going? Because I think it, like, we all have that experience, right? If someone remembers something about us
and
asks us about
That's
it,
right.
like,
oh.
it's such a great feeling, right? I would love to know, like, what neurochemicals get released when that happens. But the art of asking a good question is just so powerful. And that book you alluded to by David Brooks, How to Know a Person, that was one of my big takeaways from that. Is just like, okay, get more curious, learn how to ask better questions. And I think that we find when we show interest in others, that does create a sense mm-hmm. of reciprocity, right?
Yeah. And I think we underestimate the power in the relationships we already have.
Mm.
And we overestimate, well, I just need to go find new people. And I often tell people, you know, who do you already have around you that you could go a little deeper with?
Yeah, that's
that,
right.
That you could take to coffee, that you could see if they want to exchange phone numbers. Like we put ourselves out there in all the different spheres and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. The article talks about several different things that we can all do to kind of enrich, deepen, and find more fulfilling friendships. And one of the things that it said was to lean into low effort opportunities,
yes.
which is, I think, what you're speaking mm-hmm. to, Pastor Heather. It's like, what do you already have built? You already come to church.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
You already come every Sunday, mm-hmm. 9 a.m. and 11 a.m., 8 a.m., 9 a.m., 9:15 and 11 on Sundays.
Starting in October.
Starting in October.
Nailed this episode.
Go to bridgeway.church. Come to church. You're invited. The point is, if you're already coming there, like maybe that's the spot.
Yeah.
Another thing that the article said is that we should set small connection goals each week, right? And so I think that that's really like the next step if you're feeling loneliness or just even if you're not, right? Mm-hmm. To say, okay, what is one way that I can connect better this week? I use this thing called a monk journal, which I really, really like. And it's just kind of this way of like, framing your life and scheduling your days and whatever. And one of the parts of it at the beginning of every week is that you're actually supposed to set a connection goal.
Mm.
How am I going to try to connect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last thing is making friends is really helpful when you lean into spaces where there are people, which
yes.
I know is obvious, right? Like, of course. But I think that I've spoken to so many people who, you know, express loneliness or saying, hey, I want more friends. And then you ask them to describe their week and they're like, hey, I go to work and I go home. I go to work and I go home. And I think that that is not the best way to make friends.
Yeah.
And so then what they do is they say, well, let's get online somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And again, I'm not sure that that's the best way to make the most fulfilling relationships.
Yeah.
So we, look, just want to encourage, you know, you who are listening to lean into making friends, no matter what stage you're in, if you're very young or if you're, you know, if you're a little bit more seasoned, that friendship is not impossible and that it's something you should totally lean into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Pastor Heather. Appreciate you joining us. All right, well, welcome back. And we are going back in time. We are now to Sunday morning.
Magic.
Sitting outside on the courtyard at Bridgeway with the one and only.
The legendary.
Ashley Saren.
Hello,
the woman
hello.
Of God herself.
Now, thank you for having me.
You know Ashley from the announcement videos, from the worship team, from any of the number of other ways she's served. Ashley, you and I have known each other from when I was a volunteer and you were a participant in BYA.
That is correct.
Which
yes.
I'm sorry to say, we have both aged out of BYA a very long time ago.
That was a long time ago, Brian.
But we have all, sorry for the reminder, but we've asked Ashley to join us because in addition to all of those amazing things, she is the principal of Roseville High School, and because of that, she has some pretty unique perspectives on kind of teenagers,
yeah,
and
that's right.
she gets to see them in a way that most of us don't, mm-hmm. and we wanted to bring her here to talk about how kind of parents can stay involved and support their teenagers and preteens as they go back to school. So I believe you have 5 things for us.
I definitely do. Right? I was able to narrow it down.
Talk to us about the first one. What is the first thing you'd recommend for parents to think about or do to support their students in high school?
All right. So probably the biggest thing that you could do as a parent is to support your student in getting involved and connected in the school. So whether that's sports or clubs, extracurriculars, co-curriculars, really encouraging them to find their place, to get connected, and to get that community.
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of schools, and of course I'm speaking from a public school perspective, but a lot of schools have opportunities that span the board of how a student could get involved. Not everybody's athletic and loves sports. Not everybody's into band and music. And there's all different things involved in the middle. So definitely encourage them. Most all schools will have something like a club rush or some sort of, hey, here's your list of clubs you can get involved in. Yeah. But as a parent, that is the biggest way you can ensure a successful high school journey for your student.
And there's certainly value in the activities themselves. Mm-hmm. But if I'm hearing you correctly, and I think this is the part that it's easy to miss, that the real value comes from, like, it doesn't really matter what the activity
is. Yeah, that's right.
Just find a smaller environment where you can have deeper relationships. Is
correct.
That right?
And that's where those deep relationships come from. Because if you have that core group of people and you know there's, hey, at least one thing in common, or both part of the greenhouse club or whatever it may be, then you can have that smaller connection. Yeah. And a lot of times on a larger school, just having that smaller connection is really important.
Got to find your people. And I mean, my kids are in middle school, but man, I saw how that was transformative for them in their kind of adjusting to, hey, this new school environment. So I just can only assume it's an even bigger deal for high school students. Mm-hmm. So hit us with number 2.
All right. Number 2 is for you parents. There is communication that comes out weekly, daily, sometimes multiple times a day.
And Are we supposed to read that?
We all get frustrated with the number of emails we get. Yes, read that communication. Know what is happening at the school. Most schools will also have a daily bulletin that's posted, or there'll be some sort of activities at a glance or something. This is really, really important for a couple reasons. One, you can know what's happening at the school, so you can then have conversations with your kid about what's happening. It helps at the dinner table. Oh, hey, I heard that there was a fundraiser happening for the Interact Club at lunch. Were you able to participate in that? Or, I heard that this is coming up. Are you going to join it? And it just really helps you to know what's happening, to encourage your kid to get involved at the school.
What kind of stuff do you find like really detrimental when parents miss out on in terms of communication from the school? What kind of stuff, like, if you don't know this, it's actually going to be a big issue for you?
Well, we have had a few things, like, I think of freshmen and seniors. There's big things that happen for freshmen and seniors. And so we have had situations where parents didn't know they had to come pick up their kid's Chromebook and their kid's schedule and all that before the first day of school as a freshman.
Oh, wow.
And then the freshman showing up, but they don't know where to go because they weren't at the orientation ahead of time. And same with seniors for all of the graduation things that come up. So there's some very important evening events or orientations or things that we need you at, that we need you to know about, so that way your student can have the most success either that year or the following year or whatever it may be.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. Man, showing up your first day as a freshman's hard enough. You show up and, oh gosh.
Realize your parent like dropped the ball and you don't have any of your stuff together.
Exactly.
I would go home and never come back.
Oh man. All right. What's number 3?
All right. Number 3 is that your student now is really growing into being that young man or that young woman that's going to take them into adulthood. And so we really, in high school especially, a little bit in middle school, but in high school especially, we encourage that self-advocacy for your student. So if they're having an issue with a teacher, it's not for you to jump right in and try to solve the issue. And I know that's really hard. It is, you can have those dinner table conversations with your student about, like, hey, sometimes you have people in your life, a boss maybe that you don't always love, a teacher you don't always love, but you've got to figure out how to be successful anyway. And then you encourage them to go have the conversation with the teacher or to email the teacher or so forth. So that self-advocacy is really important.
Is there a coaching element in that for parents to even kind of to prep their kids for those types of conversations?
Absolutely. I think that would be absolutely imperative. And teachers are always in support of the self-advocacy piece. So even as a parent, if you really feel like, oh, I just don't know how well it's going to go, when you reach out to a teacher and say, hey, I am not talking to you on behalf of my child, but he wants to come in and see you and he's really working on these different things. Teachers want to connect and work with parents in su- support of the student growing in responsibility.
Yeah, oh, that's good.
That is good. Yeah, talk to us about it, your next thought.
All right, the next one is more on the mental health, social, emotional side of education. So what I really encourage parents to do, there's a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings.
What?
A lot of change that happens in high school. And your job as a parent is to be that safe space for your student to come home after their day and just talk about what they're feeling and what they're seeing and who's doing what and what's happening here and all of that. Listen and validate. It's really easy for us now that we're way on the other side of high school.
First of all, way.
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 I mean,
some of us are way. Hey, listen, some of us are wayer than others, but come on now. We're all still way past.
I just have a high school reunion coming up that is making it very clear to me.
So, boy, that's
how
a,
outside of high school.
Don't appreciate how big that number is getting.
But you want to listen and validate those emotions. It's easy for us to look back and be like, okay, yes, you just have a crush, or oh, girl drama, or okay, it's not that big of a deal, and kind of devalue what they're going through because you know out on the other side, it really wasn't or isn't that big of a deal. But for your student, that is their whole world. Perception is reality.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right? And so really being there to be that safe space. And one of the reasons why that's so important is what, not only does it help you, give you opportunity to teach them in the moment different things that can come up, but it helps you kind of see and know their personality even a little bit more now that they're in high school.
That's good.
And then it helps you be aware when that personality starts to shift. Mm-hmm. And we always want to be concerned when personality starts to shift. I'm not talking about emotions going up and down. I'm talking about somebody who used to be very, very outgoing is now becoming a little more reserved and so forth. And that gives you more of an understanding when maybe there might be a deeper mental health issue that might be going on with your student. Yeah. But because you've taken that time to talk with them every day, you can actually see that.
Yeah,
that's good. So I'm wondering what you would say to parents who would be nervous about, you know, when their kid comes home with a value set that maybe they didn't raise them with, or with some ideas about self and maybe even identity that are just kind of incongruent with what they were taught in the home, and what does it look like to validate the kid's experience, but not support them leaning into whatever ideas that maybe their parents don't agree with? I can imagine a parent would be like, I don't want to validate everything my kid feel. What does that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So y'all know this. You can't just tell a teenager what to do and expect them to do it, right? I can't look at a teenager and say, you have to believe X, Y, and Z. And so the encouragement, and we see this a lot, especially at the high school level, the encouragement is to understand that if you have raised them with a certain foundation, they will come back to that foundation. They will find that safety foundation. But what they're doing right now is they're maybe pushing the boundaries, or they're trying to discover, they're getting competing value systems and they're trying to figure out for themselves what they want, all of that. And the most important thing you can do is listen without passing judgment. You can validate the emotions, the struggles, the feelings. You don't have to say, oh yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. I'm going to fully support you in, you know, doing drugs now or whatever it is, right? Yeah. But you can still try to get to that deeper why is it that maybe they're starting to sway from that value system, but also just be encouraged that the testimony you have with your child is in how you respond to them when you are at those places of disagreement. We have seen so many relationships between parent and student just completely severed because a kid was maybe going through something for 6 months or a year or 2 years that they're going to come out of on the other side.
Yeah. And when that perspective as a parent is to just kind of want to shut things down immediately, you realize, I mean, I had a conversation with someone just last week where I was sort of trying to counsel them not to do that. And they were not having, they were not hearing me, and that's all right. But just to go, like, what I was trying to help them understand is if you step on this really, really hard right now, you are destroying the relationship.
Yeah.
And when the relationship is intact, kind of anything's possible. But once you have made it known to your student, whether it's your student or another student, hey, you are not safe with me, then there's really no possibility of further conversation. And, but at the same time, to recognize, like, okay, that can be really painful as a parent, I think, to try to walk through, oh my gosh, I don't understand what's going on with my student. Oh my gosh, I've raised them a certain kind of way, and now this is happening. So it's that angst is understandable. But that's also, and I'd like to hear your perspective on this. I think about there are so many issues that parents can face that we as parents just have to kind of prep ourselves for how we're going to respond, like now, not in 5 years where it becomes an issue, right?
That's absolutely. Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, I guess maybe to what extent have you seen maybe the value of that in how parents navigate things with students, or how parents or how students stay close with their parents in the midst of all of this craziness of high school and being a teenager?
I think the biggest one is just being there and available for your student. And so when you were talking about, okay, I can tell you, like, hey, I highly advise against this, or these are the things that are concerning, but you know, some people have to actually touch the stove to know that it's hot, even though you can tell them it's hot. But what you, like, don't you as the parent want to be the person when your child touches the stove and has a burn, they come running to you and say,
that's right.
I touched the stove and it hurts, right? So you want to make sure, pick those battles, you know, there's going to be a lot of them. Pick those battles. I would say to stay focused on always making sure that you provide a safe space for your student to come and talk to you about whatever it is that's going on. And just trust that if you have that foundation of those values, I promise you they're going to come back around to it. It might not be in a month or 6 months or 2 years. It might not even be in 4 years, but they will come back around to it when they see that what they're experimenting with or messing with is not the safety and the peace and the love and the joy that you've raised them
in. I can testify to that, right? That, like, there were some decisions I was making in high school that, like, my mom was not excited about. And I remember a conversation we had where she just said, well, you know, this doesn't feel good, but I love you. And that created space for me to come back and say, you know, Ma, you were right. You actually weren't wrong. And I think about that analogy of burning yourself, right, of a kid burning themselves on the stove, and the reality that if you don't create that safe space, then your child is walking around with a burn and no place to get treatment.
Yeah.
Correct. Right?
Or where are they going to get that treatment?
Correct. From their friends,
Correct, correct. Yeah. What do you think, there's been this kind of large discourse kind of swelling about social media and phones in school. What are your thoughts about how parents kind of work with their kids and walk with their kids through kind of that area of social media and cell phones?
Okay, so I feel like as a society, we need to go back to the year 2000 before social media existed.
Help the people.
That's what we need to do. I am not a fan of social media. Yeah. I have never seen one single positive thing come out of social media at the high school level. In fact, the majority, if not all, of our bullying issues that come into the office, of mental health issues that come into the office, can be traced back to some sort of online social media or conversation or post or whatever it may be. But I know that we live in 2024, so we can't not have social media. So my strong, and again, if you go really hard and fast here and say absolutely no, and I'm going to put all of the things on your phone, the lockdown browsers or whatever on your phone, and I'm going to make it, students will figure out a way if they really want it. And so the conversation is not so much about what are the tips and tricks I can put on my kid's phone to keep them from accessing social media. It's about raising, like, the internal motivation from your student and making it so that way they don't find their value and their need from social media, from friends on social media and so forth. For you as a parent, the one of the biggest things you can do is do not let your kid take their cell phone into their bedroom with them. Cell phones are only to be used in common areas and are not to be around you when you are sleeping at all, because they won't sleep. They'll just stay on
That's
it.
That's right. Yeah. Now, as I've kind of explored a lot of the thinking around, you know, cell phones and young people and all of that, obviously it's a live issue in my own life and my own family. But something I've heard is that a lot of the resistance to decreasing cell phone use on campuses is actually not coming from students. It's coming from parents.
Yeah.
Has that been your experience?
Yes. It is this. So we understand. I know there have been some school districts that have gone completely cell phone free, like mm-hmm. no phones at all.
Yeah.
As at a high school level, I am not actually on board with that. I do think, especially high schoolers, they have jobs. A lot of them take care of their younger siblings. A lot of them are responsible for driving and so forth. They do have responsibilities that they need their phone to be able to communicate with.
Right.
And so a lot of parents are like, I don't want my kid to not have their phone because I need to be able to get a hold of them, or I need them to be able to get a hold of me.
Yeah.
And there are opportunities, like if something happens at lunch and there's a girl really upset about it, and she's could be a boy too, typically it's a girl, and she's in the bathroom and she's crying, and she can text her mom and kind of get that immediate support right there. So
yeah.
I'm not anti-cell phone, I would say. Uh-huh. It's really that social media piece where you're getting your value from social media. That's the concern.
Yeah. And I've talked about it on the show before. Read Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation, parents. And I mean, the research is not ambiguous on the harm that social media does to teenagers. I think he advocates minimum age 16. And certainly I would support that. But I think that your comments about phones and just kind of to go, okay, there's a middle ground between phones and social media everywhere and no phones at all.
Correct.
There's some middle ground there. All right, give us the last one.
Okay, and then the last one is specifically for those of you who are Christians and raising your teenagers in the Christian faith. One thing that I really want to encourage you as you have conversations with your student and encourage your student in is to take ownership of their campus on that spiritual side. And what I mean is if every student that has the Holy Spirit in them, every Christian student is walking around campus, as they walk through their hallway, just say a prayer over that space, right? And you don't have to close your eyes and say it out loud, right?
Sure.
But you're just saying a prayer over that space. God, I just pray peace and joy and love through this hallway. And that's it. And then you go to your next class. And every time you open the door to enter the class, Lord, I just pray for peace and love and joy in this classroom.
Yeah,
and if every single individual student did that in every classroom, in every hallway, every day, I fully believe that it would completely change the dynamic of our teenage social structure.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, to that end, can we close today by just asking you to pray for like parents and students who are
absolutely
going back to school and doing the thing?
Absolutely. Dear God, thank you so much for the opportunity to just speak to parents that are out there right now with teenagers or soon to be high schoolers, Lord. This is such an integral and important time of their lives, God. And I know that we truly want to help them make it through this season so that way they could be successful and healthy and happy and spiritually strong and have everything they need. God, I just pray for wisdom and peace in every household of those with teenagers, Lord, that the parents will have the wisdom of when to press in and when to ask the questions and when to give space, and that the teens will actually have the wisdom to know, okay, when is this something that I can't handle on my own and when do I need additional support and so forth. It is such a difficult time. It's a beautiful time. There's so much joy involved in high school, God, but it can also be difficult, and I just pray peace over the parents' angst that they might have, peace over the students' angst that they might have, that they will just know that you have placed each individual student in each classroom on each campus for a very specific reason, and that they are meant to be there and supposed to be there, Lord.
Yes, Lord.
Thank you so much for all that you do for us and continue to do for us in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Ashley Saren, we appreciate it.
The
thank
legend.
You so much.
Thank you.
For being
appreciate
with us.
It.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, for our game today, Pastor Judah, the world traveler himself, and I are going to play travel agent. We saw a silly little article on BuzzFeed that had this headline: if you live in the United States, here are 18 unusual bucket list destinations you won't need a passport for. First thing, it said 18. There were 20 on the list.
Stop lying, BuzzFeed.
What the heck? And we're not going to list all 20, but we will link to the article in the show notes. But we are going to give you our top five unusual bucket list destinations from this article and briefly explain why. So, Pastor Judah, we will start with you. We have not shared our list with each other, so it will be interesting to see
if there's overlap.
So, let's start at number five and go all the way to number one.
Lord, okay, trying to do this in, like, the order that I want is crazy. All right, what's also special about these places is that they're in the United States.
Yes, which is all cool. In the United States.
All right, so the first one that I was really, really interested in, it was Hanging Lake Park in Colorado. It's one of only two hanging lakes in the entire world, and it's named so because the lake hangs off like a cliff.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that description sounds like a waterfall, so I'm like, why didn't they just say like waterfall? But the picture looks really beautiful, and they describe it as looking like Croatia, which is a really beautiful place that I've really wanted to go for a long time. So that's one.
Love it.
I was really interested in the Redwood State Park in Northern California, which
right
is really
here.
Close to me.
Yep.
With trees, some being over 360 feet tall. And I tried to go there once, and then like the particular, I think, trail I was trying to go in, a part of the park I was trying to go in, didn't allow dogs. So, and I happened to have my dog with me. So
okay. Good choice.
Couldn't do that.
Number three.
Definitely want to go to Alaska. Again, I've been there before. You can see the Northern Lights. When I was there, it was like the 22 hours of daylight season.
Yep.
So I did not see the Northern Lights.
Which is a trip, by the way. I've been to Alaska in the summer also.
It's weird,
and
right?
It is very weird.
Like you have to have blackout
Get
curtains.
Get that tinfoil on your window.
100%. And then there's the Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado. And I think that a part of the reason that I'm so interested in that is because I am currently rereading the Dune series by, I think it's Frank something. Anyway, so that looked really interesting. Is that four or is that five?
That's four. That's
okay.
Number five.
I think the last one that I'm going to do is Jasper Beach, located in Arcadia National Park in Maine. And if anybody knows me, I'm not a big fan of the beach. And the reason I'm not a big fan of the beach is because sand sucks.
Yeah,
it's awful. It's a result of the fall.
Amen. Preach.
And this particular beach in Arcadia National Park has all of these like really pretty polished red jasper stones on its banks instead of, it looks at least from the picture, instead of sand. And as the water pulls away from those rocks, the rocks make this like tinkling sound. And so it's described as the singing beach.
Yeah.
And that just sounds like amazing. Like the beautiful noise, the beach with just rocks instead of little rocks, which I guess is what sand is. It just sounds amazing to me.
There you go.
Which ones were you interested
in? Okay, so we only had one overlap.
Oh,
wow. But those were all...
I really thought we were going to have a bunch.
Great choices. Mm. So for me, number five was Mount Rainier up in Washington. I went to Mount Rainier when I was a kid, but I would love to go back and explore around a little bit more, do some hiking and all of these things. Number four for me was Northern Lights, which actually the article said there are places in the continental United States where in the right conditions, you can see them. So for example, like the panhandle of Idaho, which I don't know if you like Coeur d'Alene is far enough north to see it or not, but I love the city of Coeur d'Alene. It's a really neat area. So I'd love just to see the Northern Lights sometimes. My biggest thing about Northern Lights is I always thought you had to, number one, travel really far away. Mm. And number two, it's like in the wintertime. So if the weather is terrible, you're just kind of hosed. So, okay, you've spent all this money and made all these arrangements and now you see clouds. Mm. So that's little nerve-wracking to me. The third is actually a place that I've been,
ooh,
but I want to go back, and that is the Hoh Rainforest in Olympic National Park in Washington. I went there the day after running a marathon, so we did not do a lot of walking around on that particular day, but it is an extraordinary place, and the pictures you see, I mean, it is just magical. So I would love to go back there. Number two, Badlands National Park in South Dakota. I think the colors of the mountains look incredible. And as anyone who has seen my water bottle knows, I love national parks. So the opportunity to go there would be incredible. And number one, Antelope Canyon in Arizona,
yeah,
which I've had many people tell me about before, and the color of the rocks, the patterns on the rocks are just incredible. And years ago, I went to Utah to hike the Narrows in Zion, which was one of the best days of my life.
I want to do that so bad.
And the next day, we went out to Bryce Canyon, And Bryce Canyon and Antelope Canyon are very different, but it's kind of the same gist. And I just, again, the colors and the formations and everything of that place blew my mind. So Antelope Canyon. Oh, did I say, what state did I say? It's in Arizona.
It is in Arizona.
Yeah. Okay,
it's also considered sacred by the Navajo people, which is just kind of cool to me.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, and it's one of those, like, you can't just like wander in there. You have to get a tour and everything else.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, yeah. Well, hey, you and I both love to travel, so helping the people here with some recommendations. Never too early to start planning for 2025.
If you're here in Sacramento, the Redwoods is a couple-hour drive. Go up there and stand beneath those beautiful trees. Get outside, see the world. God made it beautiful. He wants you to enjoy it.
Amen. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week with another episode of Engaging Culture.